We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
Eric Larson is America's preeminent nonfiction history writer. His best-selling books stand out for their storytelling narratives, but also their attention to detail, especially when it comes to what the historical characters in his books actually said or wrote. There's no speculation. Larson only quotes what is verified. Larson's newest book is about the period between Abraham Lincoln's election in November 1860 and the start of the Civil War, with the bombardment of Fort Sumter in South Carolina. Eric Larson is with us on The Spark today to talk about The Demon of Unrest, a saga of hubris, heartbreak, and heroism at the dawn of the Civil War. Eric Larson, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Eric Larson will be appearing with NPR's Steve Inskeep this Saturday at the Scottish Rite Cathedral in Harrisburg at 2 p.m. Tickets are still available through Midtown Scholar Bookstore. So there have been tens of thousands of books written about the Civil War, an estimated 18,000 about Abraham Lincoln himself. But you hadn't written about either topic until now. In fact, you have said that you were unlikely to write about the Civil War. So what inspired you to write The Demon of Unrest?
Well, first of all, to correct one thing, I believe the way I phrased it was, I would never write about
really?
The Civil War.
Okay.
I'm on record as having said that. As my mother said, my late mother said, never say never. So anyway, so the way it came about has a lot to do actually with the pandemic. In the Wayback Machine, we go back to 2020. I had been in the midst of my book tour for Splendid and Vile when the world shut down and I had to fly home, and actually fly home on my wife's birthday. So I found myself with some unexpected time on my hands. And I just started to look for what would possibly be my next book idea. I looked at various things. Now, in that period, as today, there was a lot of muttering among fringe groups about secession and civil war and so forth. And I just started thinking about how I'm not a Civil War buff, as you know. And I just started thinking, well, how actually did the Civil War start? And I started looking online at various sources and thinking, you know, maybe there's a story here. Ordinarily, my MO would have been to jump right into a physical archive somewhere, maybe the Library of Congress, maybe go down to Charleston and just see what was there with my eyes fresh, you know. Couldn't do that because of the pandemic. Archives were closed. I definitely was not going to fly or take a train to one, but I found this online. I found this trove of records. It's called the War of the Rebellion, the official records of the Union and Confederate armies. And I started reading this and I was sort of fascinated, and I ordered a bound volume because I really don't like doing online research. I ordered a bound volume, volume one, of course, which came to my pandemic readout. I disinfected the book first and then started to read. And what this thing was a compendium of hundreds of documents from the antebellum period leading right up to the bombardment of Fort Sumter and a bit beyond in scrupulously curated chronological order, letter, response, letter, telegram, report, and so forth. And this is the kind of thing that, as a writer, this is like a gift from God to me. This is my narrative spine. This is my chronology right in one place. Started reading this, and I found it very compelling, this inexorable drive toward the Civil War. You know, you read these documents, you just want to say, stop it. Don't go there. You know, don't, it's like a horror film. Don't go down in the basement, right? Don't go down in the basement. So I started working more energetically on the subject. Still was not committed. I always like to quote Jimmy Buffett, this is my superpower, indecision. Indecision may or may not be my problem, you know? And so I wasn't totally sure. And then along come the events of January 6, 2021. sitting at my desk in New York, watched everything unfold, watched for hours. I mean, I found it so riveting and appalling at the same time. And I realized then, this is not a dead, obsolete story. This is a story for our time. So I became, that's when I basically pulled the trigger and got, so to speak, got more committed to doing this book. Did I have moments of severe regret, you know, trying to read, you know, even a fraction of all those books? Yes.
I've heard you say that before about some other topics as well, but you mentioned the events of January 6, 2021, and two events or scheduled events that stick out in 1861 and also in 2021, where there are some parallels, and that is indeed the certification of Abraham Lincoln's election. 2021, obviously, was Joe Biden, and inauguration day for those two presidents. So talk about those parallels.
Well, one of the things I was struck by is that in 1861, the two moments of grave national concern were the certification of the electoral count and also the inauguration. And as you pointed out, doesn't that sound familiar? There was grave concern about whether the electoral count would come off, in part because the person who was going to do the counting, the vice president at the time, had been Lincoln's foremost opponent in the presidential election. There were actually four candidates for the presidency, and the vice president came the closest. But the electoral count actually came off okay. There was a period when there was sort of a mob clamoring to get in to disrupt the thing. But General Winfield Scott, commanding general of the U.S. Army at that point, was a pretty strong-willed guy, and he had salted Washington with troops, cannon, and so forth, because he was not going to let anything happen. That was quite refreshing. And then comes the inauguration, which there was a great concern in 1861 whether that would come off. There was rumor that Southern militias were massing and would charge across the Potomac and seize the Capitol before letting Lincoln take command. But in between, there was this very interesting period where Lincoln felt he could not speak out during this period because until March 4th of 1861, he really was not president. But on his way to Washington, you know, he arranges this 13-day journey by train from Springfield to Washington, D.C. to literally let the country see him, see this guy they voted for, hear him, hear his weird laugh and his reedy voice, you know, just get a sense of who this guy is. And along the way, there is more concern. There is the fear. And it began to seem very real, although historians have debated that ever since, that he might be assassinated before he got to Washington. So the whole story is fraught with all sorts of weird little inflection points.
Yeah, that assassination plot, Lincoln was in Philadelphia, then insisted on coming to Harrisburg here in Pennsylvania, and then went on to Washington, where Baltimore, they thought with the assassination, if there actually was a plot, was going to occur. So Lincoln is elected in November 1860. There's some misinformation in the South about Lincoln. Southerners thought he was an abolitionist, that he was intent on abolishing slavery, but that wasn't the case. I mean, misinformation then. So what was Lincoln's attitude towards slavery?
Yeah, that drove Lincoln nuts. And honestly, I can't underscore how the South felt about Lincoln upon his election. I mean, it really Southerners saw him as essentially the Antichrist, that they believed he had one goal, and that was to abolish slavery. To abolish slavery was to basically abolish Southern culture, society, and so forth as they knew it. But what Lincoln was saying, and it really frustrated him that he couldn't get this message across, what Lincoln was saying is that he would not interfere with slavery where it existed already. He would also even go so far as to honor the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which the North reviled. This was an act that allowed Southern planters to come north with impunity to retrieve fugitive slaves and bring them back down to the South. So Lincoln goes so far as to endorse that as well. Now, Lincoln did have a goal with regard to slavery in that he did not want it to expand beyond its current boundaries. That was the thing he wanted. But the South was not listening to him. They were not listening to the message that he was delivering. They didn't believe him. They felt that he was an abolitionist through and through. So yeah, misinformation played a big role.
And that led South Carolina.
Well, self-delusion. Self-delusion played a big role.
And that led South Carolina to secede from the Union.
Yeah, yeah.
So talk about that. I mean, South Carolina, you know, I hate to make it sound like, okay, we're talking about backwoods South Carolina. In 1860, 1861, we are, right?
Well, yeah, South Carolina was a state, very primitive state, very, very much an agricultural state. And it was in pretty severe economic decline and also decline in terms of its political power in Washington, which sort of compounded the frustration Southerners felt after they had convinced themselves that they were prey to northern tyranny. So the South, which had always been a rebellious and kind of cantankerous state, even to some other Southern states, it was kind of an embarrassment. They saw South Carolina that way. But South Carolina was hell-bent on seceding. They felt that they could do a whole lot better on their own. And so, you know, comes December 20, this is after Lincoln's election, it comes December 20, they pass an ordinance of secession, all very legal seeming in South Carolina. This was going to be a bloodless thing. They were going to secede and then negotiate with the United States for possession of fortresses and so forth. Diplomatic relations would be established and all would be well. So they secede December 20, and then things start to really intensify in terms of potential for conflict.
We're going to talk about Fort Sumter itself, and I find myself, Eric, putting a P in Sumter. You point out in the book that Lincoln, when he wrote about it, always put a P in Sumter.
Lincoln always put a P. Lincoln was a terrible speller. He had these eccentric spellings of things, and he would not shake it. He spelled inauguration wrong every time.
So let's talk about Fort Sumter. How did Sumter become the center of attention for both North and South in 1861?
Yeah. So as South Carolina became more and more interested in secession, the federal presence in Charleston Harbor became more and more of an affront. The United States, the Union, which became the Union, the United States possessed and operated a number of forts and an arsenal in Charleston. There was a fort called Fort Moultrie. There was Sumter, which was a classic sea fortress surrounded by water, begun construction in 1828. By 1860, it was not yet done, but it was still a fairly imposing structure. This federal presence, especially Sumter, with this giant American flag flying from the top of the fort, it was just like sticking up a thorn in the eyes of the planters of South Carolina, and they insisted that first that there be no change in the disposition of those properties, with the idea that eventually they wanted to acquire them. At one point, they actually just sent commissioners to Washington to say, "Okay, we just want to buy these things. What's the problem, right?" Well, there was a problem. These were Union federal properties, and these were not going to be given up without a fight. So the War Department assigns a colonel, a major Robert Anderson, puts him in charge of these federal properties in the harbor. And what's interesting about Anderson is that he is Southern born. He is a former slave owner. His wife was born in Georgia, daughter of a prominent Georgian, Revolutionary War hero, also accustomed to owning enslaved blacks. The Andersons, by this point, by the way, had sold their holdings in enslaved human beings. But so Anderson takes over the federal properties in Charleston Harbor. And there was speculation that this was not an accident, that he was assigned there. There was the thought, perhaps, by the already Southern-leaning War Department, the Secretary of War, that maybe he would be the man to smooth over smooth conflict, or even in the best case, perhaps just decide to turn over the properties to the South. But Major Anderson was what really marked him was a sense of loyalty, not to the United States, but to the United States Army. He had made an oath, and he was not going to violate that oath. So secession is declared. Things are getting really dicey in Charleston. He senses this. His headquarters is initially in Fort Moultrie, which is indefensible. It was designed to defend against attack by French, British, and English ships, not from Americans coming from behind. So he cooks up a plan to take his very small garrison, 75 men, and their families, to secretly, under cover of darkness, from Fort Moultrie to Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor. He succeeds. It's a remarkable thing. And even Southern commanders praised him, sort of damning by faint praise, but they praised the maneuver. So he moves this garrison to Fort Sumter. The first inkling that Charleston has that this has happened is smoke and flames rising from Fort Moultrie, because he's left some men behind to destroy the cannons and disable them and so forth. So now, not only is there this imposing fortress in Charleston Harbor, but it is deemed to be impregnable. And it is Anderson's job to make it even more so. It was not complete. It was meant to have 650 men. He had 75. Guns, the so-called tubes, were lying around the parade ground, not yet mounted. And his job then was to very quickly get that fort into fighting shape, because he was afraid there was going to be armed conflict. And so that was the setup for what ultimately led to the bombardment.
So Anderson was a hero. Let's talk about someone who wasn't. James Buchanan, Pennsylvania's yeah. James Buchanan. I mean, okay, so why was Buchanan so ineffective?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question, because by all counts, when he was elected president, on paper, you would have thought he would be a fantastic president because of his prior political successes and so forth. But he was, in fact, inept, passive. His administration was very much Southern leaning, and a number of them actually defected to the South after things and accelerated. Buchanan, his one goal was to end his presidency without a war on his side of the ledger. His goal, above all, was to retire to his beloved estate outside Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and just dwell there in peace and leave Lincoln to the wreck he left behind. So he's a very interesting character, very passive. Mm.
We only have about 3 minutes left, and there's so much here, so many different characters. Talk about the bombardment of Sumter itself.
Yeah. Things degenerated. April 12. There had been talk that Anderson was willing to surrender the fort, and he was actually empowered at that point to do so if he felt that was necessary. But when a group of officials from Charleston came out by boat to ask about it, Anderson's answer was less than satisfactory to them. He was fudging, and they didn't like that. They knew that time was running out here before some expedition might arrive from the north to rescue Fort Sumter. So they issue an ultimatum to Anderson saying, we're going to begin this bombardment in an hour at 4:20. They didn't quite do it at 4:20, but 4:30 they did. And that's what started the Civil War. Mm.
You see a famous painting of the bombardment of state of Fort Sumter, and there's a body there. No one in the military was killed. Now, there were some laborers killed. I didn't know that. I learned that from the book. So, I mean, again, there's so much to talk about here. But one of the things that's interesting is, how did the attack on Fort Sumter lead to the Civil War?
Well, so here was this attack on a federal property. Lincoln, by now, is president. And he does not want, he is adamant that these forts should not be given over to the Confederacy. So the bombardment occurs. Ultimately, Anderson has to surrender. Lincoln, the next day, after the final march out of the fort, issues a proclamation calling for militias from all the states, including the seceded states. That was an interesting maneuver on his part, calling for all the states to provide militias because there was going to be this conflict, and he wanted a large military force. This was the final straw for the South. One by one, the final states exited the Union. Both sides squared off, and soon after that, as Walt Whitman said, the real war began, which we all know as the First Battle of Bull Run.
And actually, that was a few months later, but when, you know, and both sides thought that this would be a short, I won't say bloodless, but that there wouldn't be a lot of casualties, and it ended up with 750,000 people killed in that war.
Yeah, there was a popular saying at the time that any conflict between North and South would generate only enough blood to fill a lady's thimble. And another fire eater, one of the activists of that era, he pledged that you know, the war would be so short and so small that he would eat the bodies of anybody killed because he didn't think anybody would be.
Yeah, they exaggerated a little bit, went a little bit to extremes. The book is The Demon of Unrest, a saga of hubris, heartbreak, and heroism at the dawn of the Civil War. Eric Larson. Eric Larson will be appearing with NPR Stevens Keep Saturday at the Scottish Rite Cathedral in Harrisburg at 2 p.m. Tickets still available through Midtown Scholar Bookstore. Eric, always great talking with you, and I will see you on Saturday.
Yeah. Looking forward to it. Thank you.